Going to continue the hour with part two of a three-part series on rabies made possible by Grifols, a leading global healthcare company. Dr. Charles Ruprecht is our resident rabies expert. He earned his veterinary degree from Penn and a PhD in biological sciences from Wisconsin. He now teaches at Auburn, and he previously served as chief of the rabies section at the National Center for Infectious Disease at the CDC in Atlanta. Dr. Ruprecht, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Aaron, for having me.
So this is part two of a three-part series. Part one, we talked about rabies in general, and we started to get into the process of what to do when you are exposed, how to seek medical treatment, and what kind of medical treatment to seek. But that's going to be our focus for this particular segment of the three-part series. So as we get into that important question, first of all, what constitutes being exposed to rabies? How much do you have to be exposed before you have to start worrying about seeking treatment?
Thank you, Aaron. When we're talking about an exposure, it doesn't mean just seeing a possibly rabid animal. So, for example, if you're out on your back deck and you see bats at night, that's not an exposure. Even although it's not recommended, if you were to pet a rabid animal. Let's suppose you're at a petting zoo, a child, and they pet a rabid sheep or goat or even kitten or puppy. Just petting an animal, that's direct contact, but it's not considered an exposure. An exposure is defined as either any penetration of the skin by teeth, meaning a bite. It's what we call a transdermal across the skin exposure. Because the virions that are being excreted, virions are small virus particles, in the saliva of a rabid animal, have to enter the skin. They have to enter a break in the skin, such as from a bite. Or, again, if a child's at a petting zoo and they're petting the animal, petting around the mouth, and they get saliva from that rabid animal, who hopefully is vaccinated and shouldn't be rabid at all, if that child puts their finger, now contaminated with rabies virus contaminated saliva, into their nose or mouth or eye, it's what we call a mucous membrane exposure. Most of our exposures occur via bites. Mucous membrane exposures can also occur. And we have to remember that a bite from a dog, a raccoon, a skunk, or a fox are going to be much bigger and more dramatic than, say, for example, the smaller bites and the smaller injury caused by bats. And oftentimes when people, for example, either pick up a bat that they think may be dead or they've never seen a bat, and the animal in self-defense will go ahead and bite very small but sharp teeth and very small puncture wounds, what we don't want people to do, particularly in children, is to neglect that, to say, oh, that's such a small bite, that can't be important. Any animal bite, regardless of rabies, has the opportunity to promote infection. And so washing that wound very well with soap and water is one of the three ways that we prevent rabies in exposed people. First maxim is don't get exposed at all. That is, don't get bitten by an animal. Don't come into direct contact with animals that you don't know anything about. Stray animals and certainly wild animals. But if that occurs, first aid, always wash those wounds well with soap and water. Or if it's in your eye, for example, it would be flushed the same way just with water as you would if you had some kind of contaminant, for example, in your eye. After that, you seek medical attention. So, for example, if it was a dog or a cat, dogs and cats and ferrets can be observed for a 10-day period. And if those animals remain normal over that period of time, they're not considered to have been rabid, and you don't require post-exposure prophylaxis, that is, additional medical care, vaccines, and immune globulins. That's great that we know enough about the epidemiology and pathobiology of rabies in these three species, because most of our animal bites in the United States are due to dogs and cats. We have millions of dog and cat bites. And so knowing that, if those animals don't show signs, no prophylaxis is needed. Similarly, if you were to just be minding your own business, you're out in the backyard, and a rabid raccoon or skunk or fox runs over the fence and bites you, and that animal is able to be safely captured, submitted to a veterinarian, its head is submitted to a diagnostic laboratory, and very rapidly, state diagnostic facilities can tell whether or not that animal is rabid. Majority of the time, the animal won't be, because there are a wide variety of other things that can cause abnormal signs. So if the animal does bite you, either you or wildlife control officers, for example, can capture that animal and determine if it has rabies. If the animal is not rabid, confirmed by a laboratory, then you don't require prophylaxis. Worst case situations, you're bitten by an animal, the animal's diagnosis comes back positive for rabies, then you'll be directed by your healthcare providers, by your local or state health department, to go and receive what we call post-exposure prophylaxis. That'll entail additional washing of that wound to try to get rid of any contaminants, dirt, and any virus that could be in that wound that hasn't already gotten into the cells. Very vigorous and appropriate washing of those wounds for at least 15 minutes. After washing those wounds, because rabies viruses are going to be getting into the cells in that area and won't be washed away, we're going to have what we call rabies immune globulin infiltrated. Human rabies immune globulin is essentially a plasma product. It's obtained from individuals who are vaccinated against rabies. They develop virus neutralizing antibodies against rabies, and their plasma is purified and it's prepared to make human rabies immune globulin. It's basically the immune globulin fraction of their blood that is obtained, and that's infiltrated into the wound to try to neutralize rabies viruses that have not been washed out from that vigorous first aid. Only one dose of human rabies immune globulin is administered, and it's administered at different concentrations, because think of a wound, if you've got multiple bites about your legs, on your arms, on your hands, etc., each of those wounds is going to have to be infiltrated to try to neutralize any virus that's in those wounds, as opposed to just a single bite, say, in your fingertip. The third component, after washing of the wounds, after infiltration of rabies immune globulin, is the administration of rabies vaccine. Although rabies immune globulin is called passive immunity, obviously those antibodies that are being administered are anything but passive. They're binding to rabies viruses in the wound and neutralizing them. Active immunization is what the vaccines will do. Once you're administered a series of these vaccines, you'll start to make your own antibody. So passive immunity from rabies immune globulin neutralizes the virus in about that first week before you start making your own antibodies in active immunity from vaccine. Wound care, immune globulin, and the first of at least four doses of rabies vaccine administered on day zero. That's the day that you show up, typically at an emergency room, day 3, 7, and 14. Those are the current. We have administrative bodies in the U.S. that help recommend best practices. It's what we call the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, who review for practitioners the epidemiology of the disease, how it's caused, where we expect to find it, and what to do in the event of exposure. Wound care, infiltration of immune globulin, and the first of four doses of vaccine that are administered. These are the three really key parts of how we prevent human rabies after an exposure has occurred.
And all of that's got to be done very quickly, because once clinical signs appear, we talked about this before, that's pretty much it, right?
Correct. These viruses in the world are the quintessential examples of nerve-loving agents. We talk about neurotropic viruses like rabies virus. It means they're nerve-loving. They move into our nerves. And obviously, once they get into the spinal cord and brain and start reproducing, or what we call replicating, it's very, very difficult to prevent. That's one of the reasons why we want to receive prophylaxis, appropriate care, as soon as possible after an exposure, because these viruses are moving inevitably from the periphery into our peripheral nerves, into our spinal cord, and into the brain, where once they start reproducing and cause inflammation, death is almost inevitable.
I've been speaking with Charles Ruprecht of Auburn University, talking about rabies, conversation made possible by the healthcare company Grifols. This has been part two of a three-part series. We've got part one already up on our website, chapelboro.com, and we'll have part three next month. Dr. Ruprecht, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Aaron.